Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today I get to welcome Master Corporate Executive Coach and author of The Respectful Leader, Greg Ward. And by the way, I've got that book right here on my desk. Greg often says he's lived four lives. First as a professional actor, writer, director, and producer in New York and Britain. Second as a specialist trainer for the New York City Police Department. Third is a freelance journalist on assignment throughout Europe for the BBC and other UK media. And his last life is what he does now, serving as a speaker, consultant, trainer, and coach on respect, leadership, and emotional intelligence, all topics that I'm passionate about. Greg is the author of the best-selling, award-winning business fable, The Respectful Leader, which I just mentioned, and he is the founder and executive director of the Center for Respectful Leadership. We're going to be talking a lot about respect. I guess you're figuring that out. Greg is also a highly sought after keynote speaker at global conferences and events, most recently in Dubai. And just as an aside here, he's also a little league umpire in his spare time. And he finds that the children on the field usually behave like responsible adults, and the adults in the stands usually behave like irresponsible children. We've all seen it. Greg, welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. It's good to have you here.
It is great to be here, Denise. Thank you so much for that lovely introduction.
I think I ran out of breath. I was like, there's so much. If you heard me gasp, it's because I wanted to get it all in there. Listen, before we get really rocking and rolling here, tell our audience a bit more about you that I might have missed.
Well, As you said, I lived a life that even today I kind of step back and go, whoa, how did that all happen? And I think for me, one of the most exciting things that ever happened to me is while I was working as a freelancer, a journalist in Europe for BBC Radio and a number of other newspapers and magazines, I got a call. From one of my editors, who was a Scot and kind of a dour, you know, aggressive guy, like many of my editors were. They thought I was just a dumb Yankee, and he said to me, he says, "I bet you don't know what's going on in Berlin right now, do you?" And I said, "Heck yeah, I know what's going on. The wall's coming down." And he goes, "Oh, you do know, do you?" And I said, "Yeah, I know about it." He goes, "Do you want to go?" And I'm like, heck, yes, I want to go. So I covered the fall of the Berlin Wall in the fall and early spring of 1989-90. And I have a piece of the wall. It's not very big, and there's no graffiti on it, but I carry it with me, and I show it to people and pass it out at my keynotes and conferences and things where I lead trainings. And it's really interesting to see people ooing and awing over a piece of concrete. So isn't it fascinating?
Yeah, it's not the concrete. It's the story. It's the history.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact that you were there. I mean, how many of us would say that?
It was an amazing time. I was very surprised, to be honest with you, by the reaction of some of the folks who lived there. The East Germans, as you would imagine, because they were on the communist side of the wall, part of the, at that time, was the Soviet Union, they were overjoyed, as you might imagine. I actually went to the East side a number of times. They were driving in fiberglass cars. Many of those cars, when they ran out of gas or broke down, just were left by the side of the road. They lived in these awful, what's called the brutalist style of architecture, these apartment blocks that were just, oh my goodness. And so, of course, for them, when the wall came down, they were overjoyed. They were very, very excited. The West Berliners, surprised to me, I guess I didn't think it through, were very, very frightened, very, very scared. And I remember talking to this one woman, elderly woman, who said that she had relatives on the eastern side. And I said, oh my goodness. She was a Westerner, my apologies, a Westerner. She had money. She had a very nice home and so on. And I said, aren't you excited about seeing your relatives after all these years? And she said, no. They're communists. They're coming to take everything I have. And that was a very huge eye opener for me, that the schism between her in her family was that deep and that strong. And eventually, over time, of course, reunification happened of Germany, and one could still argue to this day what she and many West Germans and West Berliners were worried about, of course, was that the influx of the communists would dismantle what they built and all their resources and finances. And what, you know, one could argue today that, you know, despite all their problems, they still are probably the most robust economy in Europe. So it's it was fascinating time for me. And I look back at it and I look back at my life and I go, wow, I've been really, really fortunate.
You have. And I'm sure, you know, you just kind of let us know that they were able to work it through, which we always do as humans. You know, we really want things to work. We don't want to be fighting and quarreling and terrified all the time. But were you ever?
Right.
I think I know the answer to this. Were you ever able to follow up with her?
I was not.
Oh, that's too bad.
I so wanted to. And you know, a freelancer's life is they barely give you enough money. They pay you just enough for you to go on assignment, file the report, and then get home. And so going back to follow up was not in the budget. So I never did get back,
that's
unfortunately.
A shame. Yeah. I bet you would have loved to have heard how things, how life changed, if she was able to reunite with her family, if she was able to allay some of those fears, because they sound perfectly rational if that's the way you have lived.
Yeah, and I have been back to Berlin. I've been back to Europe many times in many years later. And Berlin is a thriving cultural capital of Europe right now. And there's tons of millennials there who are doing incredible stuff. So I can report that the city is unified and it is thriving in many ways. So that I think that's a good thing.
It is. I mean, if we can see that all over the world, we're happy with that. So we are going to thank you. That is a fascinating story. Take a picture of that piece of the wall, would you, and send it to me?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I won't be able to touch it, but I'll be able to see it. And I have a passionate interest in history, and I'm really terrified, which sounds silly, but if I'm going to be terrified about anything, this is the one I pick. And that's that our history is being lost to us for so many reasons. People just aren't paying attention to it. They're not being taught it. They're not delving into it and going, oh, my gosh. That was fascinating, and there are parables and parallels rather to what's going on now. There always are if you go look for them, if you know that they exist. So I would love to see a picture of that if you would.
I will send it to you, absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah, it's not very big. It fits in your hand.
That's perfect. I mean, that way you can carry it with you. I would be concerned, though. This is how my brain works. I would be concerned that if too many people touch it, they're going to wear it out. They're going to start wearing it down. You need to put it in a baggie.
I do carry it in a plastic little plastic box, and when I pass it out, I often say, "Here, touch a piece of history. Please return it to me, all of it." Don't bite off a piece as it goes around the room, and so
we get rub it.
It's pretty robust. It's a pretty good little piece of concrete, and it people find it fascinating to look at it and to touch it. And in the early days when I passed this out, and, you know, I'm talking to 1,000 people in a room, and I watch this thing go around the room as I'm talking, I used to think, oh, somebody's going to steal it. Never, ever. No one even dreams of it, as far as I can tell. It always comes back to me. In fact, sometimes the last person who has it gets up out of their seat and walks it up on stage and very carefully hands it back to me. Isn't that interesting?
That's lovely, actually.
Yeah.
That's respect.
So that is respect. And people never, ever, you know, I don't worry about it at all anymore.
Good. Yeah, I can see, I would be worried too. You know, just, you know, things go missing in the oddest places. But now that we're talking about respect, you have said that respect is a murky, misunderstood concept and therefore undervalued by most leaders who consider it a warm and fuzzy and a nice to have. When I read that, I just kind of went, ugh. Let's hope that more leaders don't. I actually said something a little more pithy, but you get it. So let's talk about that, you know, what respect really is, because you say, and rightfully say, that respect is a key driver of performance, partnership, and productivity. And trust me, I have learned this throughout my own career as a solopreneur. I mean, I used to try to do it all on my own. I used to try to, you know, tell people this is how I want it. That didn't work. So let's talk about that.
Absolutely. What most of us are facing now in our workplaces is that we are working faster. We're being asked to do more with less. You know that old phrase. And be highly productive and perform at the peak all of the time. Add into that these little devices that connect us to everyone in the world that we carry around in our pockets or our purses with us all the time. And in fact, I am guilty of charging it on my bedside. And even before I get out of bed in the morning, I have the phone in my hand. I'm one of those people. And
are you still married?
I am, because she's doing the same thing.
All righty then.
We're both terrible. And we are facing the kind of connectedness and kinds of requirements to perform that we've never, ever seen in world history. And we have developed such a need to perform and such a need to produce that we stress ourselves enormously. And as managers and leaders, we drive hard to keep up that momentum and meet our own expectations and meet those of our bosses and leadership and so on all the way up the chain. So that puts enormous stress on all of us. And what happens psychologically to us when we're under stress is we tend to shunt respect and treating people, you know the old saying, the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which is a very nice way to lead. But it also forgets that people are different and some people want to be treated differently. So we add in what's called the platinum rule. You may have heard about that. It's do unto others as they would have you do unto them. So that's the essence of respectful leadership. But when we're under stress, we tend to shunt that to one side. We say, oh, that's not necessary. We don't need to do that right now. We've just got to meet the goal. We've got to hit the mark. We've got to keep up the momentum. Well, what all our research and studies show is that if we shunt respect to one side, people who feel disrespected by our behavior, especially if we're leaders, they won't tell us. Instead, they will ruminate upon it. They might tell their colleagues. They might whine and groan. And they will also, all our research tells us, is they will become less loyal to the organization. They might even waste time avoiding the person, avoiding us if they feel disrespected by us. And they may even get involved in slowdowns or just looking for another job altogether. So disrespect is extraordinarily costly, and we ignore this cost at our peril. And this is why I'm so passionate about respect. It's actually a very, very good thing for business. And if we recognize that and practice what I call the simple respectful dues of leadership, by golly, we see a lot of really, really good impacts and results from that. Does that help to understand it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. It makes sense. And listen, I'm more left brain than right brained, but I meet in the middle and I play around with both. You know, I poke my brain with a stick half the time, but typically I'm a lot more logical than I'm emotional. But that doesn't mean that I don't understand that if I'm not respected, and I can, you know, we're spidey sense people. We get it. We know when we're being disrespected.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know,
oh, yeah.
After a while, we're like, hang on a second. And then it becomes almost, it's an emotional thing. It's a logical thing. And then it becomes almost
yes.
a physical thing. Because you're like,
right.
I don't want to go in there. You know, I don't want to go in there. It's toxic in there. So if you can, give us some, I don't know, case studies where people, let's just pick, you know, maybe a factory or an office where they were just unconsciously disrespectful and it bit them right in the butt. Do you have any stories
sure.
like that?
I do. I had a client a number of years ago in the financial services sector, which were the result, basically a bank, which was the result of a merger. And they had the two banks that came together had two completely different cultures. One was very laid back. It was kind of a rural bank. And when I say rural, it served farmers, it served agriculture. It served a different kind of clientele. Well, the more dominant bank that came in and purchased the smaller bank, the rural bank, was very much a big city bank. And had lots of professionals and wealthy people on its rolls and so on and so forth. So it had a different culture. And the problem was that these two cultures were so diametrically opposed that the folks in the smaller bank felt completely run over by the folks in the big city bank. And so they basically shut down. They basically just retreated because they felt so overwhelmed. And it kept showing up in, you know, a lot of banks will do customer service surveys and quick, how did we do kinds of emails and things like that. Well, the leading indicator that there was a problem was that their customer service numbers were way down than they had been previous to the merger. And that's when they called me. They said, we don't get what's going on here. We don't know why because on paper, the merger made absolute sense in terms of assets under management and so on and so forth. That made a lot of sense. And they were bringing together two banks who were serving completely different clientele. So they're diversifying their customer base and all that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of sense to it on paper. Financially, it made sense, but what was happening is they completely forgot about the differences in culture, and they did not pay any attention to it, and they kept saying, our problem is we don't know how to give customer service. Well, what we discovered over the course of doing the engagement is the problem was that they didn't – it wasn't that they didn't know how to give customer service. It's just that they didn't know how to serve each other. And what we have found over and over again, if you disrespect the people that you work with, well, guess what? That's going to bleed over into how you treat your customers. So does that help elucidate what I'm talking about?
It really does. And to go in a slightly different direction, I understand completely what you're talking about, culture. I'm in the Southwest Louisiana. I'm 15 miles from the Gulf as a crow flies. I'm in a rural area, which I like. It's quiet. you know, people ride around with their, you know, dogs in the back of their truck and their shotguns in the back window.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's pretty rural, and I enjoy it. But I moved here from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh,
look,
okay.
I have to tell you, you talk about a culture shock, and this is kind of silly, but right now everybody's in the grocery stores, or they were. The first time I went into the grocery store here and somebody actually raised their head, smiled, and asked how I was doing, I went into a statue. I just went, oh, my God. They have faces I didn't know. And this is no joke. I mean, I was shocked. So I can almost understand why maybe a city-driven person would not understand or really be able to communicate easily and calmly with people who are now like me, who were kind of laid back. And we say, hey, how you doing? And, you know, I mean, it's just natural. But when you're in a culture where it's not natural to say, hey, how are you? How can I help you? How can I be of assistance? Rather than, okay, we need to do this. Here's our goals, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
I can see why people would just go, no, and let's take it a step further. Oh, hell no. So
right.
I get it.
Right. At the end of the day, what we help the leadership understand is this dynamic that they had. Well, I mean no disrespect, but these are bankers. They were looking at their balance sheet all the time. And I said, it's not the balance sheet that matters right now. It's taking care of your people, all of your people. And fortunately, the CEO, and there were a number of people in the C-suite who got it and understood, and they went about a kind of change process with the organization. Now, that isn't to say it went smoothly. In fact, there were a number of people, even in the C-suite, who said this is a bunch of politically correct baloney. And they, you know, people just need to get over it. And if they don't like it, they can go work somewhere else. Well, if you have that attitude about your people, they're, like you said, the spidey sense is going to take off. You're going to sense
definitely.
It, and you're just going to say, yeah, maybe I should find another place. So that was one of the other leading indicators, is their turnover was significantly higher than the industry average. And I helped them understand that it's not that their competitors were offering any better salaries. It's just that people believed that the culture in their competitors was better than the culture they were currently in. And that's why they were leaving.
And see, that, to me, being a logical person, that should have been looked at before. You know, you're taking two completely diverse cultures, groups of people, and trying to just say, okay, I'll get along now, we'll see you later. Yeah, that works.
Yeah, yeah.
So why wasn't this, you know, taken into, you know, any kind of perspective before the merger? You know, somebody should have said, look, we're going to have, you know, Billy Bob over here dealing with, you know, Sir Anthony Mix-a-Lot, whatever his name is. Yet we've got to make sure that they understand how to get along and cooperate and really work well together. Nobody thinks about that? And if they don't, why
not?
Well,
I think that's a very valid point. But I think some people don't quite understand how important emotions are. And they see those as, okay, we're at work now. Yeah, you know, we're not supposed to be all emotional. Well, the neuroscience tells us, especially in terms of respect and disrespect, if I treat you as a colleague, Denise, with respect, you actually, and I want to clarify that, in a way that you consider respectful, because I need to be careful as a leader. If I treat you in a way that I think is respectful, but I don't know it to be respectful in your eyes, then it's possible I could misstep, and you might consider me being disrespectful when I had no idea. So if I treat you from a neuroscience point of view with respect in a way that you want to be treated, what happens in your brain is your amygdala, which is hard to pronounce, but you've probably heard of it, releases this little hormone, little known hormone called oxytocin. And it's also called the bonding hormone or the love hormone. And you get a little hit of that. You do, Denise. But what's really interesting is because I treat you with respect, and if I know I've done it in a way that you find respectful, my brain, my amygdala, sends a signal to release a little of oxytocin too. And we feel good together. And it's just a little thing. We might not even consciously know it. But if I continue to treat you in a way that you consider to be respectful, eventually you put on what I call a pair of sunglasses. And along the on the lenses of the sunglasses are written the words, respectful person. And when you see me through those sunglasses, you are seeing me as a respectful person. It's a filter through which you see me. And it's known in psychology as an unconscious bias. You develop a positive unconscious bias towards me. And the reverse, as you might imagine, is true too. I treat you in a way that you consider disrespectful, even if I don't intend it. I just go about my business and I do my thing, and suddenly you're feeling a hit of at least three different hormones. Because you are perceiving disrespect as a threat. And each of us has different interpretation of what is disrespect. So let's say, for example, Denise, I kept calling you Denise, and I didn't know that you weren't comfortable with that, and you would prefer me to call you by your last name, or perhaps you had a PhD and you wanted to be called doctor, but I just kept calling you Denise. After a while, you would probably in your head go to yourself, boy, what a blockhead Greg is. He doesn't know this. I mean, how dare he? And you would get three different hormones in your system because of this little threat from me. One is adrenaline. We all know about that. The second is cortisol, also known as the stress hormone. And there's a third hormone, which is completely unpronounceable, so we're not going to talk about it. But the point is, we that little hormonal cocktail going through your brain makes you feel uncomfortable. You have a physical reaction, which translates into an emotional reaction, and you feel bad. You don't like it. And the same thing happens over time. I keep calling you Denise, and you want to be called doctor, for example. You eventually put on a pair of sunglasses, and across the lenses it says, disrespectful person, and you develop an unconscious or possibly even conscious bias against me simply because you feel disrespected by me. And this can reflect itself in all sorts of things that we are doing together. Every time we walk into a room together, you have this feeling of, oh, this guy doesn't respect me. I don't like this guy. You see where I'm going with this? So this is how powerful it is.
Yeah. But, you know, there's a logical way to deal with this. Of course, a lot of people are not going to just go, hey, listen, I really would like to, you know, be called Dr. Denise, you know, instead
right.
of just Denise.
Right.
Would you mind? And, you know, you can take care of it. But for some reason, a lot of people simply won't take that little extra step to correct it.
And then keep
going to see, does that disrespect or that feeling of disrespect dissipate? Do you now feel better? Do you now feel respected? Yeah, there's so many logical things that we can do, but by golly, we don't.
We don't. And mostly in the workplace, it's because of the power imbalance. It's one thing to be disrespected by a colleague. We'll probably just try to avoid them, or we might gripe to our other colleagues about what a jerk that colleague is. But when it's our boss, the power imbalance is so clear that there's a fear that if I go to my boss, and I tell him or her that I feel disrespected by them, it's kind of natural to assume that the boss is going to be defensive about that. And so when your boss is defensive to you about their own behavior, you start to worry about your job. I know it seems illogical, and it is. But that's where we go. So the power imbalance, and this is why I call our center the Center for Respectful Leadership. It's not just the Center for Respect. It's the Center for Respectful Leadership, because it's our job as leaders to understand the respect dynamics and to practice what we call the respectful dues in order to maintain really solid, productive positive relationships. And it's not that hard. It's really rather easy, as long as we understand the dynamic inside of it and recognize that this is good for business if we do it.
Now, Greg, are you seeing that more people, more leaders, are actually thinking like this, that they're saying, you know, whatever it is that we're doing really is not working. It seems to be a push-pull type of day every single day. What is missing here? What are we lacking? What are we doing wrong? I mean, are you finding that they're actually going, okay, this kind of sucks. I don't want to be in this. I'm the boss. I don't even want to be in here. How can I fix this?
That is an excellent question. And my response is yes and no. Part of the challenge that we face as a society is we're very individualistic in this country, perhaps more so than any other country in the world, any other region of the world. We are super individualistic. And we have this core belief in ourselves and our power to drive through and solve problems. And that is great. And I will never, ever say that's a bad thing. But there is an ancillary problem that comes when we drive to solutions all the time. We tend to roll over people who aren't moving as quickly or who aren't as fierce and ferocious at solving problems as we are.
And that used to be me, truly. I was like that.
Was it?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, because I'm always the smartest person in the room, you know? No, truly. I like to think I'm the smartest person in the room. But when I first started this particular business that I've had for so long now, I mean, you know, I'm an expert at an awful lot of things, and I'm a techie person. So I would ask my team, I wouldn't ask them, I would direct them, do this, do it my way. Instead of hiring or, you know, contracting with people who can do exactly what I do but are probably better at it. And once I started saying, you know, instead of just doing exactly as I tell you, why don't you give me some suggestions? How would you streamline this? What would you do better? That made a massive difference in how my company operates. It took a while. I mean, it wasn't... You know, I woke up one day and went, well, Denise, let's fix this. It took a while because I kept getting pushback. Or I would get people to just do it, but they wouldn't offer anything up. Like, hey, this is a great idea. Have you thought about this? Oh, you know, here's a new tool. Here's a new system. Once I freed them up from my little form of tyranny, and it was, boy, everything changed. So is that what you're talking about?
Now, that is exactly what I'm talking about. And I'm going to make an assumption. You're not a sociopath. You're not a narcissist. You just focused on...
Most days, no. No.
And assuming that you're not those things, you're just trying to make it happen. You're this entrepreneurial spirit, and you're going. And I'm like you. I really drive towards results as best I can. And so we don't even think about what you were talking about. We just think we got to get it done. We got so much to do. Here, I know what to do. Just do it this way. And did you have, I have a question for you. Did you have someone on your team who actually, I call it, hit you up the side of the head with a 2x4 and let you know what you were doing?
No, but my spidey sense tingled. And I kept saying, okay, this is, you know, they're doing the work, but... There were, and when one guy in particular, and he was with me for 10 years, but all of a sudden there was what I considered deliberate slowdowns, deliberate.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there was just a lot of things going on. And, of course, I figured this out long before the 10 years was over. But, I mean, I really respected his work, and I really depended on him. And all of a sudden, he was just not showing up. He was, you know, all of my contractors have their own businesses. They're very, very good at what they do. The work they do with me is side work. And, you know, I have to be cognizant of what their schedules are, how much they have to give. But this one particular guy, I mean, I was worried. I wasn't sleeping at night. You know, we were friends. Mm-hmm. You know, we still are. He's no longer with me. He got too busy to work with me. But all of a sudden, my spidey sense was in overdrive as to what's going on. And he wouldn't tell me. You know, I just realized that I was demanding more than I was giving because it had worked in the past. He would, you know, always pop up and always do, but all of a sudden he wasn't saying, you know, how about this? How about he just kind of shut down? That's when I hit myself in the head and went, you're doing it wrong. What are you doing wrong? Fix it.
One could argue that he shut down as a way to protect himself, and he wasn't going to tell you because you were his client. And
right.
At the end of the day, he probably turned his eyes towards work where he could, A, make more money, but B, maybe be treated with what he considered to be more respect.
Oh, I don't
good
doubt
for
it.
You.
No doubt
good
at all.
You
it, that... it hurt my feelings on a personal
sure.
level, and it made me go, Denise, go stand yourself in the corner and think about what you've done. And I
good
did.
Good for you. Good for you. Now, the unfortunate thing is that not every leader has your level of emotional intelligence and self-awareness. I've worked with leaders who have gone their entire careers being who you were, telling people what to do, being what we call commanding and controlling. And they have revolving door staff, and they have constant complaints coming. But they're valued by their leadership for whatever they bring to the table in terms of the business success. And we see this in all sorts of organizations where someone's been allowed to get away with that behavior, and the leadership says, yeah, okay, he's got high turnover, a lot of complaints, but HR will handle that, and that's just the cost of doing business. Well, there's a whole bunch of indirect costs that can really hurt an organization's bottom line. And if you don't think about those things, okay, a classic example, again, back to this bank I was telling you about. The other thing that they were starting to notice was, I'm sure you're familiar, Denise, with Glassdoor, the online site where employees can talk about their employers anonymously. Well,
yeah, that can get interesting.
Oh, yeah. What they were noticing is after the merger, the amount of complaining and upset on Glassdoor about their organization just skyrocketed. So, employees will talk to each other and talk to friends about how bad it is, but they won't talk to their own bosses. So, again, it is incumbent upon us as leaders to have that level of self-awareness and emotional intelligence that you just talked about, and really become introspective about yourself in a way that's positive. It's not about nasal gazing. It's not about going into psychotherapy. A good coach, and I've worked with a lot of senior executives, a good coach can turn you around pretty fast if you're willing to be turned around. And that's the challenge I find. It's the leaders who think this is a bunch of baloney, who think this is emotional intelligence is for sissies and all that kind of stuff. Those are the folks who are really, really hard to turn around. And I can tell you, I often get the call from HR or legal or even the CEO who says, hey, I got this really high performer on my team who's pissing everybody off. Can you work with the guy? And to be honest with you, Denise, it's often a man. And I don't have the research on that. I don't have the sociological studies on that. But anecdotally, we're seeing it tends to be more men than women. And it could be related to neuroscience, testosterone-fueled cultures, and all that kind of stuff. Could be there. I'm not sure. But at the end of the day, I ask the person who's calling me for help. I say it's really simple. I can help the individual if they want help, but if they don't want help, we are wasting our time. And I will meet with them, and I'll have one meeting, and I will assess, and I've been doing this for about 35 years, I'll assess in my gut if my spidey sense tells me that this person genuinely wants to change, then I probably can make some progress. But if I sense that they don't, I'm just going to turn around and say thank you, but no thank you. Your best bet is to try to mitigate the damage this individual can do. And if you terminate him, you better prepare for an affirmative defense of some kind, because it's going to get ugly. So that's because they wait. They wait too long.
They waited.
I can't tell you how many times I get a call and they say, yeah, this has been going on for a couple of years. I'm like, are you kidding me? Well, why didn't you address this when it first showed its ugly head? And that's one of our respectful dues. It's called nipping disrespect in the bud early on. Try to get it before it grows into something larger. It's much easier for me to take you aside and say, hey, Denise, you know the way you were interacting with that contractor there? I can tell you that he probably feels disrespected by that. I know you didn't mean it. I know it wasn't your intention, but you might want to become a little bit more aware of how what you're saying and doing is landing with that guy, because I think you'll get better performance out of him. I think, Denise, you would be open to that kind of coaching. It's after he leaves and writes a formal letter of complaint about you, that's when you're going to get real defensive and say, well, why didn't he tell me earlier? Well, again, it's the customer-client power differential there that prevents him from speaking to you about that.
Understood. You mentioned HR. I guess and my brain instantly went there, because that kind of where things land. But my real question is, shouldn't HR be more proactive about that? Instead, maybe the boss is not necessarily the right person to start talking with. Maybe it's HR. Like, look, you guys are hearing these rumbles about this person. What are you going to do about it? How can we help?
Right.
And not let it go
to
you. I mean, that's just ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. I agree with you. The challenge for HR, and I work with a lot of HR folks over the course of many, many years, folks in HR tend not to be not to feel respected themselves.
That's like the principal's office. Once you're in there, you're in trouble.
Exactly. HR is not necessarily perceived as a valuable resource, when in my books, it is the most valuable resource you've got in your organization. Most managers want HR to handle all the problems very quietly, to manage payroll and compensation and benefits seamlessly, and just be quiet when we're trying to come up with strategies for growing the business and just stay out of our way. I can't tell you how many times I've walked into organizations where HR have been boxed into a corner. So they're not respected themselves. So think about this. If you work in a department which isn't respected by leadership, how empowered do you feel to walk into the C-suite and say, hey, guys, hey, gals, you guys are causing a lot of problems in the lower ranks with people feeling disrespected? You're probably in HR not going to do that unless you've got a very strong spine and are willing to stand up to people. And I've met many HR people who are, but it can be exhausting time after time and again fighting that battle to get leadership basically to raise their own emotional intelligence.
It seems to me, and I don't know much about HR, I have HR clients, so what I've learn, you know, I've gleaned, my observations have been gleaned from their struggles. But it just occurs to me that if HR and management were to actually have picnics together, conversations together, and nip these things before they even happen.
Yep.
Doesn't that sound sensible to you?
It's very sensible. I think you're absolutely right. And if you're fortunate, if you're a leader of an organization and you're fortunate enough to have an HR person on your team whom you get along with and you respect, that can be a really solid, helpful partnership. And they can get you out of some pretty sticky situations if you'll let them. HR folks have to be jacks of all trades in many respects. And they also have to what we see in the C-suite is if your HR person actually can talk the talk of your business and understand your overall business strategy and contribute to the business strategy in a way that aligns with how you talk and how you behave, then generally speaking, leaders respect those HR people. It's the HR people who come from what leadership calls that warm and fuzzy, let's sing kumbaya place, that really turns people off in the leadership suite who are not in HR. And so I'm always coaching HR to be tougher, to develop a more dominant style, and to get right up in leadership's faces and tell them when they're making mistakes. Because what we've found psychologically is if you're that type A dominant type of personality, you tend to look down upon those who don't have that personality. And so when an HR person, you know, gets stronger and tougher and gets up in your face, you actually respect it because that's how you behave. And so you value it when they come at you. It's a fascinating, and it's not easy to do if that's not your style.
No, I can see where it wouldn't. But it just seems to me that and I love what you said about, you know, if HR, at least one person in there who is the leader in HR or becomes the leader, understands the culture of the business, what the leadership is actually wanting, needing, and, you know, needs to provide, then it seems to me like HR is no longer just crisis management all the time. You know, they're actually in the trenches with leadership, guiding, helping, suggesting, saying, no, that was stupid when need be.
Yeah.
And I would suggest strongly that it needs to be said frequently. So are you going to see, as you're working with people, are you going to see more of a mind melding, if you will, with HR and leadership? Because that seems like it would really be helpful. As long as they're both strong.
Here's what yes, and there's a caveat. Right now, as you can imagine, businesses are under enormous amounts of stress. I mean, it's just off the charts. So what happens when we get under stress is we let it all hang out. We revert to our childhood behaviors. If we didn't get what we want, we pounded our feet, or we yelled at people, or we cried. And so I think, unfortunately, this crisis is going to bring out the worst in a lot of leaders. And the last thing those leaders are going to want to hear is, hey, we need to be more empathetic. We need to be more compassionate.
Gotcha. Right.
And the leaders are going, wait a minute, we're about to close the doors. We're about to go under. I don't have time for compassion and empathy. Well, what I try to do is help them to understand that a little bit of compassion and empathy when the poop has hit the fan is probably much more beneficial and much more likely to result in people stepping up and doing what it takes to get through the crisis than if you start screaming at them to just do it, to just fix it. Does that make sense?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Look, in my area, I'm seeing some outstanding responses. You know, restaurants are closing. You know, there's a lot of things going on, and we're not in the epicenter of this at all. And, you know, I don't like to make this not evergreen, but for our audience, we're talking about the corona pandemic. We have to mention it because otherwise this conversation is not going to make sense. But I mean, I'm seeing some outstanding small businesses who really cannot afford to keep paying the wages of their servers, if you will, or who have gathered together and say, listen, we've got a bunch of food in our freezers. We are going to do sidewalk plate lunches. If you are in need, drive over to the front of our business. We will meet you at your car. It's $5. Yeah. We're going to feed you. People are doing whatever they can. They may well go out of business. It may be inevitable for some, but they're not going to go down without a fight, and I'm proud
of them.
That's right. And we're seeing
Me
this
too.
All over the country. All over the country.
Me too. I agree. All over the country. Here in San Diego, people are doing, especially those small businesses, are doing the same thing. And unfortunately, there are just some businesses like the hospitality industry, hotels and so on, you know, they're plummeting. Their reservations are plummeting. They've got, you know, 5% occupancy and so on and so forth. And if you're part of a big chain, maybe you're okay, but maybe not. At the end of the day, they're, you know, laying off people, and they have no choice. And I feel
they, yeah,
so
they
badly
don't. That's
about
the problem.
No.
Yeah.
Yep. They have no choice.
But, and I'm watching a lot of this because I'm fascinated. My logical brain is going, oh, wow, this is hideous. It's horrible. But, oh, my God, it's fascinating, you know, how businesses are going to survive. How can
yeah.
they, you know, temporarily repurpose their, you know, their buildings, their business? What can they do? And a lot of people are stepping up. I mean, in some areas, not here yet that I'm aware of, but I'm seeing where empty hotel rooms are, you know, opening for free for people who really
mm-hmm.
need it. And, you know, that's the way it should be because they're doing the right thing and they're engendering great respect for themselves. So what, since we're going to go with coronavirus, we might as well, I don't know just how, you know, how much we can share this in years coming, but still it's, you know, I'm going to share it in years coming, even though it is, we're talking about this because we're talking about kindness and generosity and respect. So let's go ahead and, you know, maybe make some suggestions to people who are just walking around going, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. It's
right.
time to get over that and look at your business and see, okay, where can I help people? That's really what it's all about right now. Yes, my business is tanking. It may come back. It may not. But where can I be of assistance? So let's talk about that.
Let's do. I want to give you an example. You may recall how 9/11 caused basically the country to shut down, and what a shock
I
that
do.
Was.
It was horrible.
And yes, I think we can all agree that it was just a horrific time. And one of the things that Costco did, and I'm a Costco member, and this is part of the reason why I'm a Costco member, is they gave every employee a bonus right off the bat. And you would think, oh, my God, well, retailing was going to be hit really, really bad as we think it is now, right? Well, why would you do that? Why would you give every employee a bonus? Well, what the CEO said is we're here to be of service to our members. If our staff are freaking out about how they're going to be able to pay their bills and do what they need to do, guess what? That's going to translate over to our members. So let's ease the anxiety and pain and burden on our employees, and they will in turn be of service to our members. Boy, did that work. Boy, did that work. Costco actually saw increased revenues. Same store sales, you name it, they saw increased revenues across the board even during that crisis. So they did not suffer. They had to hunker down. They had to work really hard, but they did not suffer. And I am convinced it's because the leadership said, we've got to be in service to our employees and help them out, and they will in turn help our members out. Now,
and again, that's respect.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so I think – one of the things that I'm talking about, and I think I wrote up a piece on Sunday about communication. I think it's going to be published. I think it's going out today about how do you communicate to your staff in a time of crisis. And I think you were talking a little bit about this before. You have to be clear about what you're doing and why you're doing it. But you can't forget to talk about and try to mitigate the impact of what you're doing on your staff. So I get it. If you've got a layoff, understandable. But make sure you try to offer something that mitigates the pain of that layoff. I don't know what it is, what it could be that you might be able to give them some kind of access to, I don't know, if it's a hotel, access to services that the hotel can provide, or give them a cash release, something to make the person not feel like they've just been tossed aside. Anything you can do to demonstrate compassion and empathy for how what you're doing as a leader is impacting others is going to make it a little bit better. Because what, unfortunately, what I've seen is people, and my wife works in hospitality, so she's seen this firsthand. People getting laid off and just said, sorry, we're in a crisis, goodbye. And
that's a betrayal, Greg. I mean,
a total betrayal.
Even if they understand it's coming, it's going to happen, it's inevitable, emotionally, it's a betrayal any way you look at it.
Yeah, yes. And so I'm arguing for compassion. I'm arguing for empathy. I'm arguing for a leader to say, hey, you know what? During this time of crisis, I'm not going to take a salary. I'm going to see what I can do to keep as many people on board here as I can, or at least help everybody out, because I don't need this extra $1 million that I get every month or whatever it is. Now, I know that it's not a lot of us, but if anything that a leader can do to show that they're trying to help their team in a genuine way will make a significant difference in terms of how they are perceived and also basically whether or not the organization is going to survive.
And who will come back, you know, when they do bounce back, and many will.
Yeah.
How many of these probably treasured employees are going to go, you're kidding me, right? I'm not coming back to you. I've already found something else. I'm doing something else. And let's we've only got about 4 minutes left, so I wanted to get this in, but this is a time also, it's a terrible time. There's no question about it. It's a frightening time. My brother, my entire family is in the San Francisco Bay Area. They're under stay-in-place orders. He's a double lung transplant patient.
Wow.
He sent me a text yesterday, said, look, I'm going to call my kids and have a conference call because I'm probably at huge risk and I may not survive this. I couldn't argue with him. I think he's right.
Yeah.
Do I hope he's going to be fine? Oh, my God, yes. But he's in and out of San Francisco hospital all the time in Petri dish. So, you know, we all have to be prepared for these things, and I just lost my train of thought. But what I was going to say, I got skewered on my brother there going, oh, no. But here's the thing, and this has happened since, you know, early times, the Steel Barons, the Great Depression. This is also a time of great innovation. If you are standing up and you lost your job. Okay, there's something you can do to help. Oh, now it's a new business. Be aware that you don't have to walk around going, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. Innovation is in the air. It always is. Just find your spot and do something. And now I'm off my little soapbox.
That's okay. When the old saying is when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And I would add that when the going gets tough, people get tough on each other. So we need to, hunker down, figure out how we're going to get through this and what we can do to innovate and create something new and even better, and take care of our people and take care of ourselves. I think one of the most important practices that I do is meditation. I know it sounds new agey and all that kind of stuff, but every day I sit in a chair, close my eyes, and I breathe in a particular way, and I meditate. Just something to keep myself calm and focused, because knowing me, I'm kind of out there all over the place all the time. If I don't focus myself and I don't get calm, my emotions will overwhelm me, and then I'll behave in ways that I will regret.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I have never really learned to meditate in a traditional sense. I, you know, once I start, for some reason, I either fall over and start drooling, or I create my Thanksgiving dinner list. It may be July, but I'm making out that list in my. It's the same every year.
Perfectly fine.
I don't even,
perfectly fine.
But you know what I do now? I do what I call the open refrigerator door syndrome. We all do it. You walk into your refrigerator, I open those double doors, I stick my head in there, and I'm blank. I have no idea where I'm at. So try that if meditation doesn't work.
Cool. Great idea. Love it.
It works, you know. After a while, what am I doing here? Oh, I feel better. Okay, gotta go now. Grab a bottle of water, and I'm back to work. Greg, it has been fascinating talking with you, and I really appreciate all of your insights and you know, the wonderful tips and advice, where can people find you on the web, and where can they find your book, The Respectful Leader? By the way, let me say the entire title, The Respectful Leader, Seven Ways to Influence Without Intimidation. I think that part's very important.
Thank you very, very much. You can find my book, of course, on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. You can also just go to RespectfulLeader.com, and my book's available there. And to find me, you can go to my organization called the Center for Respectful Leadership. Just Google that, or just put in RespectfulLeadership.org, and we'll pop up, and you'll find out all about the work that we're doing on respect.
Perfect. Greg, thank you so much. It has really been wonderful speaking with you, and this is also timely. And I thank you very, very much.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. So before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes and really anywhere else you consume your business podcasts. Just look for your partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Thank you again, and listen, stay safe.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.